a warning to our affiliates, we will go long today. It's my favorite time of year where we gather during March to make art compete.
Yes.
And judge art in competition accordingly. Yes. The Oscars, and this year it's Shakespeare's Best Soliloquies. I'm joined by noted actors and teachers Elizabeth Dennehy and Gregory Linnington, and noted young director Nate Cohen, and noted aging director, but wizened, let's say wizened director, Austin Titchener. Lady and gentlemen, welcome, and thank you for helping us get through this.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 18th year, number 903, Ides of March Madness. Last year, in 2023, director Nate Cohen and I chose Shakespeare's best play through a March Madness-style bracket of 32 plays. This year, Nate and I are joined by actors and coaches and friends of the pod, Elizabeth Dennehy and Gregory Linnington, who will talk us through a Sweet 16 field of Shakespeare's best monologues. If you want to follow along, both the empty bracket and the completed bracket are available in this episode's post at reducedshakespeare.com. And before the tournament begins, I'll just point out that many, many more of your favorite Shakespeare speeches would have been included had we done the complete Ides of March Madness tournament of 64 monologues. But this episode will already be over an hour long, and that would have taken much longer. Nate Cohen began our epic conversation by explaining how we winnowed down all of Shakespeare's magnificent speeches to just a field of Sweet 16.
This was a fun one. I think we went back and forth quite a bit on like what the right way to do this was. But ultimately, since we had recruited Elizabeth and Gregory into the fold for this year's Ides of March Madness already, what I ended up doing was sending Austin, Gregory, and Elizabeth the prompt to list in order what they thought were the 8 best soliloquies, speeches, monologues, etc., that exist in the Shakespearean canon. And then I compared their lists, and the process for doing a sort of seeding for the 1 through 16 was that anything that was on more than one list was automatically bumped to the top. Yeah. And then based on where it was seated in the relative brackets that it was seated within, adjusted a little bit. So there were 2 things that were doubles, where it was someone's first overall choice. So those were the first and the second seed. And then there were some fun ones that were like someone's 3rd and 5th and someone else's 7th and 8th. So ordered them that way. And then once I'd gone through the 5 soliloquies that appeared on 2 lists, filled out the rest of the bracket, starting at the top of everyone's sort of remaining lists. So for example, Gregory's number 1 overall pick was the Edmund speech from King Lear that ended up as the number 6 seed because it was the highest ranked piece that wasn't on multiple lists. And then I will admit when we got down to the 15 and the 16, I did a little bit of preference based on my own impulses here. We had 5 left for the last 2 spots, and I picked one of the ones that is my favorite and one that is, I think, an excellent one, but also has a fun little story that we'll talk about when we get to it.
Cool. Perfect. That makes a lot of sense and seems very fair. But before we started recording, I know, Elizabeth, you mentioned some buyer's remorse in your selections and maybe all of our selections.
So I'm sure Gregory will agree. I looked at the list, and first of all, my first original list was, I could have had 50 or 60 of speeches that I just absolutely love. So it was really hard to whittle it down to 32, then to 16. But I have buyer's remorse now. Looking at the list, I'm like, recently I have just been doing a deep dive with Juliet. Everybody's doing Romeo and Juliet, and I cannot believe we don't have a Juliet monologue on this list. Yeah. To me, having worked on a number of the speeches just recently, I come to the conclusion, and fight me, but I think Juliet is the female Hamlet, and she has so many wonderful speeches. I think the fact that a man of a certain age wrote this amazing character who is a teenage girl and sounds like a teenage girl. And so I really feel bad that we don't have Juliet up there, but you know, we can't have everything. So.
Interesting. Any regrets for you, Gregory, before we get going?
Well, yeah, similarly, I feel like we missed something with not having Juliet on there. I was struck really with how few soliloquies we had. You mentioned soliloquies, but we are actually in a world of set speeches.
And what's the difference for you?
Well, by definition, as I've understood it, soliloquy being a direct address to the audience, never to oneself. You're never talking to oneself. You're talking to the audience in a Shakespeare play, just in case there's no fourth wall. Thank you.
That's
as long
good.
As we're all about
that's
that.
Important clarification, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
Come at me in the comments.
I was just talking about this with my first years at Northwestern, and they were all like, whoa, when
what?
I said that to them. Yeah.
Right.
I was like, you're never talking to yourself. You're always talking to the audience. And they were like, really? I was like, yeah. And we talked about the whole, like, where the phrase rolling thunder comes from also, that they used to roll the cannonball down the chute. And that's how they would make the thunder effect in the globe.
Oh,
nice.
Can I say something?
Yes.
I think I gravitate towards speeches. It's just so hard to separate the coaching and the monologue coaching from this and what's the best. I tend towards speeches like Rosalind's speech and As You Like It, which is super active. What are you, and the character is really trying to achieve something. And I feel that sometimes the soliloquies, as gorgeous as they are, and I fought for Richard II, and there are two in that play that are just mind blowing. But they tend to go to one place and stay there, and it can be less active. My favorite Hamlet speech is the one to his mom. Look upon this and upon this, yeah. The counterfeit presentment of two brothers, because it's so active. That's my part.
No, and so, and I've understood it. Sorry, a set speech. The longest set speech in Shakespeare is Berowne's set speech to the boys. Right. That's where the people identify as men in that play. Right. So that is the longest set speech. The longest soliloquy is the longest speech that the actor has alone with the audience, right? So that's, you say set speech versus soliloquy. That's how I've always understood it. I might be wrong in my definition of that.
No, that's very interesting, probably very accurate and intriguing, because the criteria for me for these speeches is like, I have never considered myself a judge of beauty. I know what I like. You know, I can't argue what's beautiful, but I can argue what are powerful moments in plays. Mm.
I also had a little bit of waffling. I really wanted to have some comedy in there, because the melancholy speeches are so beautiful, but there's great speeches in the comedy. So I fought for Rosalind and Malvolio, the letter speech. I kind of waffle about, because I kind of feel it is an amazing speech, but I feel like it's a scene. Like the scene works because of what the speech is doing to the others. Mm-hmm. So I was waffling a little bit about that, but I just wanted to say that I, even in bad productions of Twelfth Night with a bad Malvolio, I enjoyed that scene because of the writing. And I just thought I'm sticking it in there.
Cool. Well, I think that's enough caveats. Should we dive into, I don't know how we're going to judge this, Nate. I'm leaving it to you to make decisions and sign things.
Well, so I think what we can do, what I would suggest is that we just start working our way through the bracket. And what I'm going to ask is, when, just to give the audience some context, the first time that we name each of these seated speeches, whichever of you feels the most passionately about it, just drop like a couple of lines of it, so that people have some like, oh yeah, that one, you know, whatever. Or if there's like a really iconic phrase from it, et cetera. And then I think I think rather than like reading through the whole bracket to begin with, Austin, do you want to just start doing the matchups and go from there? Does that feel right?
Yeah, let's just dive in, and I will post, you can go on the website for this episode's listing on reducedshakespeare.com, I will post this, and you can follow, post a blank one, and then farther down the page, the results, so there are no spoilers if you want to avoid them. So you can go to our website and follow along.
All right, so what I'm going to propose we do is actually work our way from the bottom of the bracket up, so that we get to the like highest seeds at the end of working our way through the first round, which is a little bit of a, like, normally you would go top left and just kind of work your way through it. But we're going to start bottom right.
I love it.
So the first matchup that we have is the 11 seed, which is the Antony monologue from Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 2, versus the Edmund Lear monologue from Act 1, Scene 2.
So this is the excellent foppery of the world is how that begins.
Great. Right. And how does it, the Antony one... This is friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears, right?
Classics all. I might well have suggested the Mark Antony speech, only because, and we'll probably mention this more than once, it's famous for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a really good speech. It's taught in universities and in government committees. About the power, military committees, about the power of rhetoric, the power of controlling, persuading the mob. It's just an excellent example of writing and a powerful dramatic moment if you can get the extras playing the mob to react correctly.
Gregory, since the Edmund was such a high one for you, can you like speak about it a little bit? And maybe even like, that's one that I think fewer people are maybe familiar with. So if there's like a little bit more of it that you want to like drop in real quick.
Yes, absolutely. I love Edmund/Will's calling out the hypocrisy, I believe, of the Elizabethan belief system, and indeed our modern belief system. What sign are you? Right. Our lives are very, I know a lot of people who are very, very much into astrology and believe that the fault is in their stars. Perhaps if Mercury is in retrograde, it's a bad time to make a business contract. It's a bad time to, make any major decisions. I won't do it until Mercury is out of retrograde. And I think that Edmund makes a very persuasive argument, not only against that, but against a lot of major religions. So I find it to be, on the one hand, he is a complete anarchist and must needs believe these things. And on the other hand, I find it to be a well-reasoned argument against the tricks that our minds play on us.
Even a stop clock or a villainous bastard is right twice a day.
Twice a day.
Yeah. It's so fascinating, Gregory, and this is why I was so excited to have this conversation, because you describing that speech is more persuasive to me of its power than any production I've seen of an actor say that speech. Mm-hmm. I've always found that speech to be, I've wanted more villainy or less villainy or something. I've wanted a clear indication of how I'm supposed to respond to this. I've never gotten what you just argued.
Huh, interesting.
Which is fascinating to me, even in a great production of Lear, my favorite Lear production of Lear that I've seen, that Edmund speech was the weakest part, where I literally, your brain just goes fuzzy because the actor hasn't made a great active choice. And even in your description was better than I've seen. I think you've convinced me what I think the winner of this seed should be.
I will also note, just as a sort of point of some sassiness here, that something we learned doing the Ides of March Madness last year is that Austin has a surprisingly hot take about Lear not actually being a good play.
Wow. not that it's not good, that it's overrated.
It was the first, it was the by far the biggest upset of the bracket last year was Lear getting knocked out in the first round by one of the back Henrys.
Yeah, one of the back Henrys.
Denny is shaking her head vigorously. Go, Elizabeth, go.
It's just with, you know, Austin, not everything is better if it's shorter, you know, just reduce the reduce.
But as we've learned to our cost, Elizabeth, separately, not together in our marriages, longer is not always better either. Mm.
And not because it's long, but I mean, I've seen many, many productions of Lear, and some have felt like they were 8 hours long. And some do not, some fly by.
Yeah.
Glenda Jackson's production in New York was just a train wreck. It's a masterpiece. I mean, you're just wrong.
It's like a hot mess of a masterpiece, though. I mean, it is an experimental drama. He's experimenting with a lot of things late in his career there. Don't you think, Elizabeth?
Yeah, it's almost a romance. It's so convoluted and full of different kinds of plays, and like Hamlet, hard to successfully realize on stage, which is either a measure of its greatness or, and I've had this argument before too, I've never seen a bad production of Pericles.
Okay,
one
so
Pericles, and it was very good.
we do have to make a decision here though. So we're talking Edmund versus Antony.
Okay, wait, but we should definitely argue on Antony's part as well, because I won't be satisfied, because go Elizabeth, go please.
Okay. Everybody does this show and they try to make the audience part of the mob. So in which case, Mark Antony can't show how facetious and sarcastic he's being, because the audience needs to go along with it and believe it. And what that production did was they had a mob on stage, and Jada Nuka, playing Mark Antony, was winking at the audience like, oh, you want me to read the will? Oh, please not. So you saw the facetiousness, you saw the facade, and you saw her playing the mob on stage. And then I got it. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, helping the audience understand what's going on and not relying simply on Shakespeare's words is a great tool.
It goes on for a really long time, this speech. So if you're in the audience going, oh, okay, all right, I'm with you. Yeah, they really are honorable men. That the fact that he's playing the mob can be lost on you. And every time I saw it, it was being played that way until this production.
I don't pretend that Edmund is in any way, it's a prose speech. It is prosaic. He's using basically antitheses as his one rhetorical device in it, as opposed to Mark Antony is using probably dozens of rhetorical devices. Putting these two against each other is, for me, it's apples and oranges. You hold a gun in my head. I couldn't tell you which.
Yeah. Okay. Now I think I might've changed my mind back. in terms of the speeches, individuals' speeches impact on the play, that would seem to give the nod to the 11 seed, Mark Antony's speech.
It is a fulcrum point of that, of the whole like narrative power of the thing right there. So that is, I think it is true. The Edmund thing is a really juicy bit of bad guy exposition, motivational setting in a very like Heath Ledger in the Batman movies kind of way.
Yes.
But the Antony speech is like the whole play kind of hinges on whether or not, which side you come down on at the end of that moment. So are we going
along,
Antony,
with every Shakespeare head yelling an agreement, Nate?
we're giving it to Antony.
So we have an upset in the first round of the Sweet 16 Ides of March Madness 2024. The 11 seed Mark Antony beats the 6 seed Edmund from Lear. Oh, well done, everybody. Well played. Well argued. This episode is going to be 5 hours long.
I'm Peter Holland. I'm the McNeil Family Professor in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Notre Dame, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC? The RSC will be performing the complete history of comedy abridged next month at the American Theater in Hampton, Virginia on April 12th and the Hilton Performing Arts Center in Fairfax, Virginia on April 13th, 2024. Check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Nate Cohen, Elizabeth Dennehy, and Gregory Linnington as we break down the brackets and discover Shakespeare's best monologue in our annual Ides of March Madness.
Okay, so we're gonna hop to the left side of the bracket now, which will make sense for those of you at home when you can look at it on the website as you listen. But so now we have the 12 seed, which is the Hal monologue from Act 3, Scene 2 of Henry IV, Part 1, going up against the Rosalind monologue from As You Like It, Act 3, Scene 5, which is the 5 seed.
I don't think this will take as long to argue. I think the Hal speech is in there. I think I suggested it because I have a soft spot in my head for it. It's the speech that got me into NYU's MFA acting program.
Can you do this? Can you do like a line or two of it so people know which one this is?
It's the one that starts, "Do not think so, I would not wish it so," or something like that. I'm paraphrasing probably. But it was age appropriate, you know, for a young man in his 20s. And I've only now just recently realized, oh, hell, I could now do the opposite side of that speech now. I could do the king's speech in response to it.
The funny thing about this is also that another thing that came out of the bracket last year was the discovery that Austin and I both have very highly positive feelings about Henry IV, Part 1. And it like outperformed a lot of people's expectations. I think perhaps because both of us were like, this is like, this play is so freaking, this guy in this play, he's doing some cool stuff and there's all these good characters. Anyway.
Elizabeth Rosalind. Talk about Rosalind, that speech. Well, or both of you, Elizabeth and Gregory. Yeah.
So I love this speech. Audition, perfect, great for auditions. She comes in with a very high status. She thinks she can solve all the problems in the world, and she gets knocked off her pins and has to scramble and think. Super, super active. She's talking to two different people about whom she has two completely different relationships. And in this speech, for those who may not know it, it's Phoebe is being horrible to Silvius, two shepherds in the forest, and Rosalind comes in and starts breaking up a bar fight. You know, what the heck are you doing? Why are you being so mean? It's taking off the earrings part. Mm-hmm. You know, she wasn't disguised as a boy. And coming in and saying, be nice to him. And then all of a sudden, wait, why do you look on me? I see no more in you than the ordinary nature sails where God's my little life. I think she means to tangle my eyes too. So Phoebe falls in love with her. And so it's super, super active, very physical, super accessible, understandable language. And I actually think this scene is as funny and farcical as the four lovers in Midsummer Night's Dream.
Hear, hear.
Properly.
Yeah, I use this. I give this to people all the time as an audition speech. I completely disregarded gender as far as this speech goes. It should be performed by people. And it does, as you say, comes in with such a hot-headed steam, and Phoebe falls for someone who is treating her like garbage for the first time in her life, and it's absolutely delightful. It's actually probably one of my favorite scenes in the canon, because we also, you know, soon we will have a Phoebe speech coming up as well. But this, yeah, this is a, I find it to be essential as far as my arsenal of things to suggest to people, and best speeches, active, super, super, super active, super, super, super active.
So I think the most recognizable line is mistress, down on your knees and thank heaven fasting for a good man's love, for I must tell you friendly in your ear, sell when you can, you are not for all markets.
This feels like a fairly strong consensus for the Rosalind speech to dethrone the young prince, despite Austin and my affection for the character.
Absolutely.
That one is easy. So, all right, we're gonna bump up to the next one up on this bracket, which is the 13 seed versus the 4 seed. The 13 seed is Measure for Measure, Act 3, Scene 1, The Duke's Speech, versus the 4 seed, which is Queen Margaret from Henry VI, Part 3, Act 1, Scene 4.
Yeah, this is the Duke basically convincing, or attempting to convince, it's kind of him putting on the habit for the first time of, he's trying to be, I think, a ghostly confessor for the first time to anyone. And it happens to be Claudia, as they are being condemned to death. It is a lot of aphorisms, a lot of sort of folksy advice. It is also almost completely anti-religious. There is no mention of God in the speech at all, which is odd for someone who is a priest. I don't know that the Duke is necessarily he. I feel like this speech operates on so many different levels. I feel like Claudio is convinced and then not convinced, because the opposite, and the one that you could actually, I would, you know, kind of put this up against, at least in my mind, is Claudio's speech later in the scene when he says, "I but to die and go we know not where, better than to be or not to be, perhaps." But anyway, it's almost a direct refutation of what the Duke has said to him. So many people cut this Duke speech and keep the Claudio speech because they think that the Claudio speech is the quote unquote better and more potent of the two. So I heartily recommend the Duke for this particular seat.
The Duke is one of those characters that everybody gets angry at Angelo in Measure for Measure. And for me, the Duke is kind of way worse.
He's the villain.
Yeah, the Duke is the bad guy. I'm not sure that's a hot take. Elizabeth, do you want to make the Margaret case?
Well, you're never going to cut this speech, are you?
Well, they're right there. Boom.
I mean, it is long and I have trimmed it for audition purposes, but... And I think it is another fulcrum speech, just so the hubris, because she brags about the death of Rutlin and then her kid gets it later. So I think that Queen Margaret, like Gregory said in one of the emails, every word she utters, just magical. And I think that she is probably the female Richard III, but she wins. She outlives him. Just who wouldn't want to play this part? Just incredible. So for the listeners, probably the most recognizable speech would either be the first one, you know, brave warriors, Clifford and Northumberland, make him stand upon this molehill here. What, was it you that would be England's king? Or that the very end, when she's mocking him and says, off with the crown and with the crown his head. And whilst we breathe, take time to do him dead. But the funnest part of this speech is when she's mocking him and she's, well, it's easier to read the lines. So where are your mess of sons to back you now? The wanton Edward and the lusty George. And where's that valiant crookback prodigy, Dickie, your boy, that with his grumbling voice was wont to cheer his dad in mutinies? Or with the rest, where is your darling Rutlin? Look, York, I stained this napkin with the blood that valiant Clifford with his rapier's point made issue from the bosom of the boy. And if thine eyes can water for his death, I give thee this to dry thy cheeks withal. I mean, just the hair stand up on the back of your neck. Mm-hmm. And it must have been so important because it keeps getting mentioned in later plays. The fact that she, I believe that she breaks the rules of war with this. At this point, because it keeps getting mentioned, and even people on her side turn on her with this. So it's just delicious.
And she's clearly a character that Shakespeare loves, because she keeps coming back in plays she doesn't need to be in.
And she's not all villainous. You actually sympathize for her. She walks around with the dead of her lover. I mean, she's a feast.
So two observations here. The first is just purely for my own delight in this process. Like, as somebody who fancies themselves someone who like has a healthy grasp of Shakespeare, it's just such a delight to do this with the three of you who have such like profound and deep understanding and mastery of like the things that are happening in these speeches and these plays and the language. So just like naming that, this is delightful from a participatory standpoint. This also seems like one where the consensus, I feel like, is fairly strongly towards the Margaret, and we can, you know, go with the power seed and move on here. Amazing.
And what I love about that is that it already sets up an amazing, horrible, difficult matchup in the Elite Eight between Queen Margaret, the 4 seed, versus Rosalind, the 5 seed.
Man,
that's going to take some arguing. I don't know how you're going to do that. All right,
we're gonna jump back over to the right side of the bracket here. We're gonna do the 14 versus the 3. The 14 is Malvolio from Twelfth Night, Act 2, Scene 5, that we talked about a little bit before. Elizabeth has already pulling at her hair about this one. And the three seed is, this is one of the things that surprised me the most, was the fact that two of the top five seeds were from Henry VI Part Three, which I feel like is not always named as like one of the great plays. I just was struck by the fact that not only did a monologue from that speech get pulled twice, but that twice two of you pulled the same monologue from this play. But this is the Gloucester speech from Act 5, Scene 6 of Henry VI, Part 3.
Malvolio speech is it? Is it
the letter?
It's the monster. Okay. Yeah. Which is a scene in and of itself. I mean, it's all Malvolio all the time in that scene.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such an unfair matchup. Could I speak to the Gloucester?
Please.
Because again, I mean, this is complete apples and oranges, and I would go to the mat for the both of them because I think that they're both incredible, incredible moments of theater. This Gloucester speech is one that I feel very attached to. I've given it to many, many students. I used it to get into OSF, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, many, many years ago. It's a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for an actor to, you know, do something intensely physical. And it is the moment after he has killed the king. He has finally done what he has set out to do as far as, you know, before Richard III takes place. Young Richard III, but what a delight to play for any young actor. And it is, I think, remarkably, you know, it, like many of the histories, the verse, there's not a lot of tricks inside of the verse. You know, it's this and it's that, it's this and it's that. A lot of antitheses. It's a very, very, it's almost prosaic in its poetry. It's and that said, it is such an absolute delight to play. This is a soliloquy, although you do have dead Henry on stage with you. You are speaking directly to the audience in this speech, and this kind of establishes, not for the first time, but it really does establish Richard's relationship to the audience. I can't speak highly enough. And Malvolio is a wide-ranging whole scene, but I'll let somebody else speak to that. It's apples and oranges. Anyway, go ahead, please.
I can't defend Malvolio's speech against. I could fight for both of these. They're, like Gregory said, they're magical pieces of theater. So an impossible matchup, apples and oranges. Malvolio, of course, the recognizable line would be, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. But for me, the most delicious parts is when he says, "My lady loves me." And then later on, "I am happy." Mm. Even though you're rooting for his downfall, I mean, it touches your heart. It's just a wonderful, wonderful moment. But I will say that in a matchup between these two, it's kill your darlings, right? We're killing babies here. I have to say, I do think that the Henry VI speech when he's Duke of Gloucester is, I think, Richard's best speech, and you need to have one of them. And so I have to give it to that.
I think I would go for that too, because it's a great reminder. If you're just looking at the bracket and you see Gloucester, it's important to remember that this is teenage Dick. This is young Richard III, you know, and it's sort of a great reward at the end of the play, at the end of Henry VI, III. Wait, what? Why am I watching this play? Oh, holy shit. This is Richard III. I know where this is going now. And I'm fascinated by the idea that whether Shakespeare knew he was going to write Richard III next, because he didn't write. We think he wrote other plays after his Henry VI plays. He wrote more comedies. He didn't get to Richard III for a couple of plays. But, I can see the playwright's wheels turning of, ooh, I think I can follow this guy into another play. I would also give the nod to the Gloucester speech.
How can you write a line like, "I was born with teeth," and not do a sequel? I mean, God.
Yeah. We're decided?
I think so. That sounds like
Gloucester versus Mark Antony in the Elite.
Oh man,
eight.
No, that's a difficult push. Yeah. Oh man.
All right, we're still
gird your loins, people.
We still got four more to go in the first round. Hopefully these are gonna, I think we're gonna have two that are a little trickier and then two that should be pretty easy. So next up we have the number seven, which is Emilia from Othello, Act 4, Scene 3, which every time I hear about this one, my brain goes, here's Amelia at the door, who we met in Act 4. circa Austin Titchener in the Reduced Shakespeare production that I was deeply in love with when I was 12 years old. So we come back home and stuck a pillow in her face. It kills her and soliloquizes about his disgrace. But there's Amelia at the door, who we met in Act 4. Who say, you big dummy, she weren't no whore. She was pure, she was clean, she was virginal too. So why'd you have to go and make her face turn blue? It's true, it's you. And then we have Phoebe from As You Like It. This is the Act 3, Scene 5, Phoebe speech. So Gregory, you, what about the Amelia? Do you want to speak to that one?
I mean, oh my God, these are both of these. Amelia is my favorite female character in Shakespeare. I'll go to the mat for that. I think that she is, this scene is as close as he comes to passing the Bechdel test. I know it was supposed to be a joke, but it still works as a mark and measure. It's as close as they come to not speaking about men, even though they are still speaking about Othello a lot. It is, an extremely feminist speech, which you find many of these speeches in Shakespeare. He definitely is a man who is at once a product of and completely outside of his time. I am intensely attracted to this speech because I find it to be the best moment in Othello. I'm speaking vaguely because I don't even necessarily understand the reasons why. It's basically saying men and women aren't really that much different at all. We have the same kinds of affections, et cetera, et cetera. Please, Elizabeth, please step
in. It's speaking truth to power, and it could be written now.
That's what I was going to say. She's almost the fool character in this play. She's the one character who's saying what needs to be said. The audience surrogate in many ways. Right. And we're really rooting for her. And I'm looking up the characters in Winter's Tale, because I forget the character's name. There's a similar female character in Winter's Tale who
Paulina,
thank you, who performs the same truth-telling audience surrogate function. I think that's a compelling argument, Gregory, that Amelia is your favorite female character in the canon. I think that's a lovely testimonial.
Incredible. Would somebody like to speak to the Phoebe As You Like It?
Tough call. I can't do it.
Tough call. God in heaven. Elizabeth, please.
Is it Think Not I Love Him, or I Would Not Be Thy Executioner?
Think Not I Love Him is what that was my thought, was Think Not I Love Him.
Okay. Can I just say one thing? I think that this is going to be fast. Think Not I Love Him is only about Phoebe and Silvius and Ganymede, whereas listening to Gregory, Amelia is speaking to the generations to come for all of time, to the whole world. It's a global speech for infinity.
Yeah.
Okay. That seems like a pretty compelling way to just collectively feel like Amelia is the winner here. The seven seed has a healthy win over the 10.
But Think Not I Love Him is amazing, Austin.
Yes, I agree. It is an amazing speech. It is an amazing speech. It is another one I give to people to perform all the time. I use it it is the very definition of antithesis. It is the definition of acting on the thought. It is a fantastic teaching tool in the context of the play. I think it can be done to hilarious effect, and it serves a completely different purpose than what Elizabeth is speaking to, which is speaking to the generations to come.
The other thing that's cool about that speech is, remember I said before that Ganymede, as Rosalind, reduces Phoebe and becomes Silvius. So if you're talking about status, and everything's about status. So Phoebe is a 2, she's a shepherdess, but she thinks she's a 10. And in the woods, she is the queen of the shepherdesses. And she gets reduced in status by her love of Ganymede. And in that speech, she goes from being a 10 to a 2, 10 to 2, 10 to 2. He's not very tall, but for his years, he's tall. And so that's just delicious. That's switching back and forth.
I love that Phoebe is a city 2, but a forest 8.
So this is also the fun thing where I was like, cool, I feel like we have a decision. And then everyone made very passionate arguments about why the Phoebe speech is incredible.
Well,
are we sticking with Amelia as the winner here?
Yeah, okay. Let's stick with Amelia. Wait, did I argue that Phoebe is not a great speech? Elizabeth, you pointed at me. Okay.
Always saying, I think what you say, and I get your point, is that the comic characters come in really late in the play. You're already like, all right, let's wrap this up. And then we get Phoebe and Silvius and William and more
Audrey, yeah.
And often they're not done as well, you know, which is another drag.
You have to remember, these people who went to the Globe had nothing else to do but sit there for 4 hours and be entertained.
I think it's important to remember that these are still great speeches. All of these speeches are all amazing.
Yes.
So it's an honor just to be nominated. Let's remember that.
So we're spinning now to the 9 versus the 8. The 9 is the As You Like It. Act 2, Scene 7, the Jayquees. This is one of the more recognizable, but Austin, do you want to speak the first line or two of?
Sure. This is all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. It's another line from the complete works of William Shakespeare that I once intoned for months and months and years and years. It's an argument that some of these speeches are famous for a reason. And that's a great observation. It's a great party piece. Mm. And the reason I would vote against it is that in the play, it stops the play cold.
Yep.
And in fact, I worked on it. Gregory is good enough to teach a lovely online workshop. And I came in with this speech trying to present it in a more active vein, because I always see it staged in plays in context where it's reflective and beautiful, when in fact Jayquees is bitter and a recluse, and he's not saying it because this is anything good. You know, there's a cynicism behind the speech, it feels to me, that makes it far more theatrically interesting in the context of the play in a way that I rarely see it done.
The thing to untie, I feel like, is why is he saying it, and why is he saying it now, right? And the Duke has just made this observation about this grand theater, the scenes wherein we play. I always imagine somebody terrible playing the king. I don't know why, the old Duke. I don't know why, but his direct reputation, his trying on of the mantle of fool for the first time. He's just asked if he could be. He hasn't really gotten anybody's permission. I kind of got it from the old Duke, but not really. So he's trying it on for the first time. It is one of those. I've done it, and so it's almost like the audience can, you know, wants to start singing along with. Okay, and now the Radiohead's finally doing Creep. You know, okay, fine, we can all sing along. You're right. You know.
But that's fascinating too.
It can be a showstopper, you know.
I was just going to say, that's fascinating too, what you're saying. I've certainly never seen it done where Jayquees is auditioning.
So Richard II, Act 3, Scene 2, which speech is this one?
No matter where.
No matter where, of comfort no man speaks. So I put this in, I don't know if anybody else did. And it was really hard to choose between this one and I have been studying how I may compare this prison. So we have really active speeches. We have soliloquies. We have rumination. We've talking to the audience. This one, for me, the poetry, I can hardly speak this speech without getting choked up. And as a matter of fact, when 9/11 happened, I don't know about you all, but I think in Shakespeare quotes, I'm sure Gregory does, and Austin, you must, that when things happen, all of a sudden things will come up to me. Like lately, a lot I've been saying, I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth about the condition of the world. And when 9/11 happened, all I could think of was this speech and the lines, no matter where, of comfort, no man speak. Let's talk of graves, of worms and epitaphs, make dust our paper, and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth. I mean, I'm speechless over this speech. It's just the most famous line, I think, was probably, for God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. There's probably other speeches in all of Shakespeare with poetry to match it, but I can't think of anything. And yes, I think if I had to choose between All the World's a Stage or this one, I think the Jayquees speech is, you know, if it's going to go up against Mark Antony, probably that one should win. But this speech just flays me. It's, And in the play, you know, he's not really that sympathetic a character, but my God, he has moments in this play that just time stops. Your heart stops.
It's one of the few characters where the part of the tragedy is a growing maturity and self-awareness, which is great, which is a lovely contrast. Oh, I'm becoming a better human being. And thus I'm realizing I'm a terrible, terrible king, you know? And that's lovely. That's lovely. I've already gone ahead and typed Richard into the bracket as the winner of this season.
Whoa, over all the world's a stage.
I think Richard will compete better further as we climb higher in the seeds. I think Richard has the ability to compete higher. But I'm willing to be convinced otherwise.
It's gorgeous. Richard, Gregory, have you ever played this part?
I have not. No. I believe that time has passed, my friend. But I always really, really, maybe we'll dye the hair. I've always really wanted to. I find him to be incredibly, I empathize, whatever it is with him. I often send people to watch Rylance doing this speech when he did it at the Globe. He does it staggeringly well. It is one of those, as you say, Elizabeth, it is one of those things that, you know, it's funny. He's charged with, at the end of it, like, stop feeling so sorry for yourself, is the immediate response to this. This is not what, people don't do this. You don't wallow in your pity. You find ways out of it. You wallow in your heartache. You find ways out of it. And he's kind of dismissed in a way. And Jake Weese is, of course, interrupted by the entrance of old Adam, right? He comes back in, very, very hungry and sick on Orlando's back. It's so hard. This is a really tough one.
I feel honestly like observational to your thing. It feels like there's more passion around the Richard speech. The Jaques one, I think, is being given an appropriate, like, it's being held up appropriately given its like fame in the canon. But it, like, what I'm hearing from you three esteemed scholars and performers of these texts is that the Richard one is juicier. So I think let's go with that one.
I also want to say one thing. You know, I love Shakespeare, read all the plays and everything, and the thing that always kind of is nagging in my head is like, why would anybody want to be a king? How many kings lived and died of old age? How, like, who would want this? Like, what, Margaret, stop, why are you trying to keep a hold of this? And finally we have somebody saying, God, this sucks.
Yeah, you know,
it's so refreshing that he's in prison and he's like, God, I would trade my place with anybody to not have this. And Henry VI, when he's he has speeches where he's like, I wish I was a shepherd. I wish I was, didn't have these responsibilities. How welcome is that? And how refreshing is that take?
The Molehill speech is what I give to people when they want to audition for Richard II and they don't want to do a Richard II speech. The Molehill speech is perfect for that. Because that's the warm-up to this. I feel like that's the warm-up speech in terms of his writing.
Nod to Richard because of its of how it works in the play.
Yeah, the nod is given, I think. We're jumping to the 15 versus the 2. So this one I'm hoping will be quick, but Titus Andronicus, Act 5, Scene 1, the Aaron monologue is the 15 seed. Gregory, I believe, is the one who nominated this one, but it's a personal favorite of mine.
Oh, you speak to it then, Nate. Go. What do you got?
Well, so I just think that this is like such a Aaron is such a unusual and compelling and Tarantino-esque villain in a way that I feel like you don't really get any other character that is quite like this. And I think that he relishes in the absurdity of his villainy in a way that is like just profoundly entertaining, and can easily be hammy and slapsticky and can go very poorly. But I think when done well is just delightful. So I just think that's exciting. This is also people say the thing, like, I feel like one of the most misstated things in Shakespeare is that Othello is the only black character in the plays, and they forget about Aaron.
Right.
So that's another interesting tidbit there, that he's got this really, really juicy Would love to see Michael B. Jordan circa Killmonger in the Black Panther movie.
My God, I can imagine. I mean, he would rip this apart. No, and I always go back to Harry Lennox's performance in the Titus film, which is, I think, one of the best things ever committed to celluloid, and him doing this speech. His vulnerability in this moment too is something that I think is often overlooked, that his baby is there, and they're really threatening to do some pretty horrible and despicable things to it. Once he susses that they're not going to do it, he kind of rips the Band-Aid right off and lets him have it right between the eyes. I mean, some of these famous lines is, you know, they're not sorry for these heinous deeds. I had not done 1,000 more. I've done 1,000 dreadful things as willingly as one would kill a fly, and nothing grieves me heartily indeed, but that I cannot do 10,000 more. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, oft have I digged up dead men from their graves and set them upright at their dear friend's door. Like,
come on.
Yeah. An amazing, amazing speech. I would teach this in Shakespeare class. So I taught 10th grade, and I would have so many boys and people, students would come up to me afterwards. Can I do that speech? Can I do Eli's speech? And I was like, no, it can only be done by Eli. You know, all the white kids wanted to do the speech. I was like, you can't touch this. No, nobody can have this.
Amazing. All of that said, it is going up against Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2.
I have up late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
With RNG.
Mm-hmm. I think this is one of those speeches like All the World's a Stage and Friends, Romans, and Countrymen. The most famous line is, I think, what a piece of work is a man. Mm. Gorgeous, gorgeous poetry and a prose speech.
Yeah. And a pivotal point of the complete works of William Shakespeare abridged, and a fundamental structural a component of all of our shows, where there's always a moment where the craziness stops and we let the poetry shine. And we always call it the what a piece of work speech, what a piece of work moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also it's a searing definition of depression, of someone who cannot see any hope, can't see a way out, is lost. You know, if you're thinking of Shakespeare's characters speaking themselves into existence, he's speaking, he's talking, so he knows that he's alive. It's incredible. And I've seen this done facetiously. I've seen it done sarcastically, which kind of kills me a little bit when I see that. I think that, you know, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you know, need an answer from him, and he just makes this up. I don't think that's right. I disagree with that.
His father's dead, for crying out loud. But 2 months dead. I mean, he has a reason to be depressed.
Yeah.
He didn't get to say goodbye to his father. I mean, a facetious would not be.
No, and he has to, he's charged with avenging his father's death, which would, you know, depress that, you know, that you have to exact revenge and commit another murder and all the hell that's going to break loose with that. I think it's gorgeous.
Well, I think it's fascinating that there's only one speech from Hamlet, and it's not to be or not to be. And just as we began our conversation, I went ahead and typed Hamlet in as the winner of this bracket. But now I'm not sure. I think we might have another major upset in the offing here.
Well, to speak to Elizabeth's point earlier about Phoebe versus Amelia, and if we're going to use a speech for the ages, there is perhaps no, you know, there's what a piece of work is meant is up there with any of the best things he ever wrote, up there with, although we have taken All the World's a Stage out for for other reasons. So, I mean, I'm on the fence. I think it's a fantastic moment in theater, the Aaron moment. It's something that we're waiting for. We're so desirous for. We really want to be on his side. And Hamlet is it's such a fantastic examination, as you say, of the human spirit and of depression. It feels that the Hamlet speech feels larger to me than
it's universal.
Than the Aaron speech.
And see, we even with Richard II, that speech is not just about that moment. It is also universal sure. as all the world's a stage. It's not like Phoebe. That is really talking about that situation.
Right.
So I think this feels like if this was the basketball game, this feels like the moment where like Loyola is up 7 points on Duke with 2 minutes left, but then like it crumbles away and Duke pulls it out at the end, kind of thing. Which is okay. It's okay for that to happen. Feels like we're leaning Hamlet. Does that feel?
Yeah, I'm fine. Okay. I'm fine with that.
I'm seeing nods.
I want to talk about, you brought up this point that why this speech and not the others?
Yeah, follow through on that.
I think maybe we've heard To Be or Not to Be so much. It isn't a great speech. I think the fire has been turned up on Hamlet at this point. He's maybe in crisis mode, and that's maybe what appeals to me more about it. It's, what do you say, Greg?
About his emotional state in the moment. Yeah. I mean, they brought in these flunkies. He knows he's got to say something to these guys who he knows certainly, but I don't think that he has much affection for. I think that he's, you know, is this something that he's really actually feeling, or is this something that he is putting on so that they'll report back to the king and tell him that he's more depressed than he actually is? This leaves me with more questions than the Aaron speech. The Aaron speech is an answer to me. This provides only questions for me about Hamlet's emotional state. I know everything that Aaron is going through. He's taking me right by the hand and leading mm-hmm. me right to the inevitable conclusion, which is I'm awesome. I'm an incredibly compelling character, and I'm going to win. I'm going to live. I'm going to survive this. And Hamlet, I don't know, it's so much more vague. So maybe I like it better because it's vaguer.
Huh. I'll say, Austin, about like To Be or Not to Be, over what a rogue and peasant slave. I kind of feel like this speech is an encapsulation of all that's going on before. Mm-hmm. It's a summation.
Yeah, I buy that. It's hard to, I mean, I only just came to recently a realization about To Be or Not to Be. It's not about choosing death or suicide. It's about the impossibility that death is a release. I could agonize about the choices, but really I would kill myself. And then what? It's not like I would be at peace. You know, we don't know what's going to happen.
Mm.
It's like I long for if it were only that simple to kill myself, if only it were that simple. It's a hard moment. And that's a longer conversation for a different podcast about the speeches of Hamlet.
last matchup of the first round.
Yeah.
We have the number one versus the number 16. The number 16 here, part of the reason I plugged this one in, this is Cassius from Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 2. And I put this one in the bracket. It was actually one of the lowest ones left. It was Austin threw it in as like a note at the bottom of his list. So it technically wasn't even in his eight, but he threw it in because of a story about Gregory and this piece of text. So Austin, do you want to like,
oh yeah, what's grab that? Story?
I will argue for this, the Cassius speech, because it's very clear. It's a great, if we were talking about a musical, it's almost an I want song. It's the hero's I want moment, because Cassius is explaining exactly where he's coming from and why he thinks Julius Caesar should not be considered as lofty as he is, because he's just a man like anybody else. And I can't quote any of the lines, but I bet Gregory can, because the reason I love this speech is that when Gregory and I were doing Book of Will together, that Nate was the assistant director on, the director Jessica Thebus invited us every day during our warm-ups to bring in a favorite speech that somebody had, if anybody had one. And I think I brought in one day the opening speech from William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, because it was the only one that I knew off the top of my head. But Gregory launched into this speech, and he was 5 or 6 lines into it before any of us realized he was doing a speech from Shakespeare. It was so natural and so well-spoken and so clear, and it felt like we were just sitting in a bar and Gregory was just telling us the story about that time that he went swimming. When in fact, holy crap, he's doing a Shakespeare speech. It was glorious. So that's why I, again, a soft spot in my head for this speech because of the way you did it that day, sir.
I'm so appreciative of that. And I will say that it was hard one. I have been doing a Mark Murphy impersonation and doing that speech. Mark Murphy's an actor at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. The first time I did this play in the year 2002, and I saw him do it 120 times, and I watched him sort of religiously do it. And then I got to do it about 110 times some years later. And playing this role, there are more monosyllables in Julius Caesar than any other play. For those of you keeping track at home, I don't know why that's an interesting piece of information, except to say that the poetry sounds prosaic. It does sound like people speaking everyday language. He's working on a completely different, more subversive level in a lot of ways. He's working on a more gut and groin level than his friend Brutus. He takes everything political very, very personally, and everything personally very, very politically. to put this up against St. Crispin's Day, which is what we're up against. I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life, but for my single self, I had as lief not be as live to be in awe of such a thing as I myself, right? Probably the most famous line is, because it's kind of the entire scene, is the fault of your Brutus is not in our stars, but in ourselves, that we are underlings. Echoing back to Edmund and Lear, if I may.
Yeah.
You can see maybe my preference is always going to be for Cassius. It's going to be for Cassius in this.
And to your point, to your earlier point, one of the hallmarks of these sports podcasts is the interruptions with meaningless stats, like this play has the most monosyllables. So well done, sir.
Sweet. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, and to that point, I will just throw in an aside about Caesar that was like, I discovered this in Shakespeare class in graduate school with Gregory's wonderful wife, Shauna Cooper, that when in the first 2 acts of Caesar before the assassination, whenever Brutus and Cassius are talking about Caesar, it's out of pentameter. It's a irregular line. It's either 9 or 11 syllables every single time that they like every line where one or the other of them mentions his name, except for one time that Brutus says it, which is when he's like talking about how much he loves Caesar to himself late at night kind of thing. Mm. And I just like, I found that doing some like little micro text work. And I was like, my God, this man is a genius. Like,
So I guess I should argue for St. Crispin's Day. It's not only a great speech, it's not only a pivotal speech, it's an incredibly influential speech in that it has come down through the ages. It has been parodied, it has been imitated. Probably the most famous imitation is Bill Pullman's speech in Independence Day. They use it in beer commercials, for God's sake. It's a great speech on its own, and it continues to resonate in our culture.
And for folks who don't know what the St. Crispin's Day speech is, just in case somebody out there doesn't know what we're referring to, this is, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he who sheds his blood with me this day shall be my brother." I would argue that to me, the reason that this was clearly the number one seed, despite the fact that it was also one of the plays that got 2 different people who nominated, et cetera, is that, as far as I know, this is the only speech that is named, not the like beginning of the speech.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, when we talk about the Jaques speech, we talk about it as all the world's a stage speech. When we talk about the Hamlet things, we talk about them as to be or not to be or whatever. This is the St. Crispin's Day speech in like capital letters, proper name. And like, yes, he says St. Crispin over the course of the piece a couple of times, but the fact that it like has its own title separate from the context of the play, to me, felt like the indicator that this is the...
It's an album cut that was released as a single.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right.
Yeah.
Cassius would probably be the B side. That would probably be the B side. It would not be. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I know what you mean.
Well, it's not dissimilar to the previous seed we just talked about. You know, Aaron. I think it feels like Aaron and Cassius have drawn really tough brackets to be in.
Well, and the other thing I will just say about St. Crispin's, harkening back to the point before about Austin and my love of Henry IV, but this speech is actually, I think you could argue, the culmination of a three-play character development arc. This is the final, you could, interesting point of view conversation about whether it's here or in the scene when he has to execute Pistol, but like that this for Henry V, who is the main character of Henry IV, part one and part two, that this is like the moment of him manifesting into the fullest version of the king he is meant to eventually become. And so I do think that there is like, this feels like the climax of three plays almost.
Mm. Piggyback on that, you have when he's Prince Hal, and he talks a lot about people talking about him behind his back, you know, the tennis balls, everybody's joking and, you know, calling on his wilder days. And the start of the speech is a really important jumping off point, because he walks in on a conversation where the soldiers and his,
his lords
are having doubts. What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? And so he's used to people, I know you all and will a while, like he's used to walking into a room and everybody getting quiet all of a sudden. Yeah. And that paranoia, I believe, and I don't know, Greg, if you've had this experience working on this speech, I don't give it to a lot of people for auditions, but one of the ways that we have found to make it active is to take that doubt and that paranoia and quell that, but also to convince himself that he can do this. And I think this is another example of a character speaking himself into existence. He becomes the king in front of your eyes. And if you start there, it doesn't leave you anywhere to go. But I think that by the time he gets to we few, we happy few, he's convinced himself.
And agreed with all of that. And to, back to Nate's point about how it's the culmination of, you know, a three-play arc, it also comes hard upon, I'm fairly positive about this, it comes right after one of my favorite scenes in the canon, the campfire scene, where he's in disguise talking with some of his soldiers who don't know they're talking to the king.
A little Harry in the night.
And the soldiers are complaining that we don't know why we're fighting. We don't know why we're fighting. And so Henry comes back in the, not the next scene, but a future scene, and says, you know what? I should probably explain to everybody why we're here. So it's a great, just dramaturgically leading from one scene to another, if this, then this. It's lovely writing dramaturgically.
Okay. So I think it's St. Crispin's, which means that we have now gotten ourselves down to our Elite Eight.
It has come down to this. Only 8 speeches left.
I'm gonna, in the interest of time, I'm gonna try to get us moving through here, because we've spoken in such depth about all of these speeches at this point. I think what I'm gonna do is we're gonna name the matchups, and we're gonna try for like 30 second, one way or the other, and then make a call. Yeah. So first matchup here,
lightning round, right?
Lightning round, yeah. When we get to the final, maybe we can like hash out a little bit more pound for pound. But
the final four. Okay. Let's get through. Move swiftly through the Elite Eight and get us to the final four.
The final four. Yeah. So first final four matchup is the 11 seeded Antony We Few We Happy Few against the 3 seeded Gloucester from Henry VI Part 3.
I mean, it's got to go to Antony, you guys. It has to. I mean, I'm voting for Gloucester, but I know that Antony is like, if we're taking personal preference out of it, we've got to give it to Antony, I think.
I was going to use my 30-second lightning round for just stunned silence, because I wasn't sure how to vote. But I think you're right. Friends, Romans, countrymen has to make it to the final four.
It has to.
Yeah.
Elizabeth, are you agreeing?
Yes, I guess. Yeah, we can't. Yeah, Friends Room, Mark Antony.
Friends Room,
it's got to be Mark Antony. Yeah, it's got to be.
Yeah. This is going to be a hard one. So this is Margaret from Henry VI Part 3, which is the 4 seed against Rosalind from As You Like It, which is the 5 seed.
It has to go with Margaret.
It has to.
Okay.
I will take your word for it. I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other.
I think you're right, though, Elizabeth. Yeah.
I'll say what I love when it happens, but I think what's going to happen is something I love. Anyway.
So what we have next one is going to be Hamlet versus Amelia from Othello.
Yeah, for me, this is a no-brainer. It's Amelia.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm going to say the same thing.
Great. Yay! Amelia's going.
Great. Let's do it. Let's do it.
That's a good question. Yeah.
Big 7-2 upset there. All right, and then now we have St. Crispin's Day as the 1 seed versus Richard II as the 8 seed.
I think it has to be St. Crispin.
So too.
Yeah.
Killing me.
It's the titled one. Yeah. Okay. So the thing
I was going to say is that the final four is features two men and two women speeches.
That's fantastic.
I did not think that was going to happen, and I'm thrilled that it has.
Mm-hmm. Also, fascinatingly, we have the final four is made up of the 1 seed, the 5 seed, the 7 seed, and the 11 seed.
Wow!
So some solid depth there. People performing well against
a lot of bracket busters in this competition.
Maybe you need to hire a new bracket maker.
No. I love it. This is the way it should happen. Let the players play. Let the speeches speak.
So Amelia versus Antony is our first Final Four matchup.
Oh, golly. So that's Friends, Roman, Countrymen versus what's Amelia's lines?
Exactly. I think that it might be telling in as much as we can't just come up with, you know, her line that's, you know, say that it does. So, you know,
let husbands know.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I know where this is ending up now.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Hang on just 1 second. I mean, the entire scene is so good. I just want to touch on it briefly before we just let it go forever.
Yeah.
Not letting it go forever.
Remember, these are all amazing speeches. But somebody has to win because, God forbid, art just exists.
I know, my God.
But I do think it is their husbands' fault if wives do fall.
Yeah. Let them use us well as let them know the ills we do, their ills instruct us. So I know.
I mean, I'm actually leaning towards Amelia here because it's just so great. I can't kill it.
No.
What is the
this while you're thinking, I will just observe that I think when we did this last year, I went, you know what? Screw it. Let's not go with the obvious choice. Let's go with the underdog more than once.
Yeah.
Honestly, when you first said which 8 we came down to, what leapt in my brain was Amelia. Amelia must prevail. I don't think
Amelia was on my list of 8 at all, for what that's worth.
For the time we live in now, it's just a really, really important speech. What are the choices again right now?
Antony versus Amelia.
Friends, Romans, Countrymen versus the speech that nobody knows.
Gregory, do you include in it when you do it is the world's a huge thing. It is a great price for a small vice. In truth, I should. And undo it when I had done. Mary, I would not do such a thing for a joint ring nor a measure alone for gowns, petticoats, or caps, but for the whole world.
She
would not make her husband a cuckold to make him a monarch.
Yeah. Really good. It's really good.
Which of these two speeches, the Amelia or Friends, Romans, Countrymen, which of these two speeches can compete stronger against the winner of Margaret and St. Crispin's Day?
Mm-hmm. Margaret is the perhaps is the stronger I mean, you'd have a hard time beating out. I mean, if it goes Margaret Amelia, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'm leaving. I'm leaving the Zoom.
I'm tearing up my bracket. Throwing. All right.
So I'm
calling up my bookie.
I think we're at a point where what we need to do is we just gotta straw poll it. And there's three of you, so we're just gonna vote, and winner of the vote, even if it's a 2-1 split, we'll advance. So, raise your hand in the Zoom if you are gonna vote for Friends, Romans, Countrymen. Two votes. Oh, there it goes. Elizabeth.
I looked away. Austin, I couldn't tell. Wow.
Oh, right. I really want to vote for Amelia, but I don't. I do think she's going to be killed by Margaret.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that. Yeah, no, it's Anthony. You're right. You're right, you guys. It's Anthony.
Which gets us to the last of the final four matchups, which is St. Crispin versus Queen Margaret.
And it sounds like I heard Elizabeth saying that Margaret should beat St. Crispin's Day.
God.
I mean, just a couple of minutes ago, I saw what I thought was going to be the championship between St. Crispin's Day and Friends Roman Countrymen, which seems right, I will say.
It does seem right. Somehow.
It does seem right. I would not have predicted this because I don't, God forbid, I think that far ahead. I'm just too lazy. But it seems right.
Yeah.
It's impossible. I quit.
All right, well let's straw poll it one more time with St. Crispin and with Queen Margaret, and we'll just see what happens. So if you believe that St. Crispin should advance, please raise your hand. No, you can't. What's that? Okay, so for those of you listening at home, Austin put his hand up. Gregory thought about it, but then didn't. And then Elizabeth raised her hand, put it back down, raised it again, and then put it back down.
I wasn't even looking.
No, I think it's I it's for me. It's St. Crispin.
Crispin.
It is.
Okay. I think that there is value inherently, obviously, to the Margaret speeches, like much, I would say it is a deeper bit of emotional, like manipulation and utilization and like access for an actor. But I do think in terms of the thing we named before of the St. Crispin Day being one, such a like powerful gravity in the canon, and two, the sort of culmination of the three, I do feel like that bumps it, which means here we are at the final matchup. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers versus Friends, Romans, Countrymen, lend me your ears.
Wow.
If we're talking about, can we just be, okay, we're coming in from a very, very, if we can maybe inject some stats into this, right? Just to look at the fact that Henry is start to finish a speech. It is a set speech. Anthony is set speeches. It is a series of them, be it interrupted by the mob, right? It's him interrupting himself. It is not a clean one-shot start to finish. It is not a piece of rhetoric, right? He's using rhetoric like crazy throughout the course of a very, very long scene, as opposed to Henry, who's like, I have this amount of time. I'm going to be this concise, and I'm going to get this ragtag bunch to go, and I'm going to get 5,000 people to go kill 50,000 people, right? I mean, there's something about that part of the statistic. Sorry, Elizabeth. So that part of the statistic, that to me, I think is valuable. Anyway, go ahead, please, Elizabeth.
No,
sorry.
I agree with you completely. I also say one of the things I love about Crispin's Day more than Mark Antony is that he's like, we band of brothers. I'm on your side. I'm with you. I am one of you. I'm no better than any of you. And that really appeals to me. And you could say that that was just another use of rhetoric, but I don't believe it. I think he really sees that he is exactly like them, made of sinew and muscle, no better, no higher in status than anybody else. Whereas I think Mark Antony is totally playing the mob.
He's cynical. And the end is a mischief. Go ahead, work, my mischief, work, you know? It's a great deal of cynicism behind the Antony speech.
So I go for Crispin.
Yeah, they're both really powerful theatrical moments, but the St. Crispin is almost actor proof.
Yeah, flawless. It is almost above, completely above reproach. I know. Yeah, I would have to say my vote would be Crispin as well. Yeah.
Okay. So wow. after all of the angst to get there, we have a unanimous consensus opinion that the winner, in a healthy but spirited game, is but a bit of a drubbing nonetheless, comes out to be St. Crispin's Day.
In a surprise to no one. In an upset, not an upset. Yeah.
No, I know, but the number one seed takes it. So that's a remarkable bit of seeding.
Truly.
But appropriately so. I mean, again, I go back to how deeply that speech has permeated into our contemporary culture.
Yes.
Do you remember Mario Cuomo basically paraphrased this speech during the shutdown when things first quarantined? He was like, "You are going to be talking about this to your children, your grandchildren, and those of you who survived it." And I was like, "Oh my God."
Was it Mario Cuomo or one of his sons?
Oh, yeah, the Andrew. Sorry. Yeah. I'm old and I'm from New York.
I was going to say, really? The Democratic Convention in the 80s? You talked? I don't remember, but all right.
He knew about it then.
Wow.
All right, friends. We've done it. We did it.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. The comments will be turned on for this episode so you can weigh in on which speeches we neglected and the errors in our thinking. Or you can send us your bracket-busting Shakespearean Cinderella stories via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. Or throw a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. You can follow me on Twitter, which I refuse to call X unless I can pronounce it 10, @AustinTichner, or on Instagram @the.shakespeareans. You can also follow my three guests on Instagram, Nate @NateSCohen, Gregory @GLinnington, and Elizabeth @AuditionMagician. Thanks, as always, to aging Shakespeare heroine Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Scott Bailey. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Peter Holland, professor, author, and former director of the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 903 2709th of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
The only thing that would have made this conversation better is if we had been together in person in a pub drinking adult beverages. Thank you all so much for your wisdom and your talent and your knowledge. What a stupidly fun conversation this has been. What should we do next year for next year's tournament?
Characters.
Best characters could be fun.
Best characters could be a lot of fun. And a lot of, best. And it could be, it would not be, and I don't, and I think it could be, again, much like, you know, genderless comparison, you know, I think it'd be really, really fun.
That might be the move.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.